crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Let me go to the issue of comments you made last night. We're talking about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Toughest deal to make of any kind of deal that I've ever seen is Israel-Palestine.
Because it's such a
toughest
mess.
Toughest deal. The Palestinians and the Israelis don't exactly, they're not exactly meshing.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the reasons that I said it last night, the toughest single deal to make is getting them together. And I've been told by some Israelis that no matter who it is, you'll never do it. I'm going to give it a shot.
Welcome to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Nachtigal, coming to you, of course, from Jerusalem, Israel. Those comments that you just heard were from none other than Mr. Donald Trump, now President of the United States. Those were given before he came into office, yet they indicate how he is going to give it a shot. That is the Palestinian-Israeli peace process. And just this past week, we saw his first major foray into this arena in his attempt to start up this peace process once again. From that clip, it seems as if Mr. Trump is giddy at the prospect of working out this ultimate deal between Israel and the Palestinians. No one else has done it, and now he's going to do it. And we've talked about in this show whether, when answering the question, whether Mr. Trump is going to push Israel too far in his quest to get this peace deal. Now, we're not going to talk about that side of it today. We are going to talk about the peace process itself and how that since 1993, Watch Jerusalem editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry called it Israel's deadly wound. Israel's deadly wound is this peace process. It was a wound that was opened up by Israel back in the early 1990s when they started to negotiate with the terrorist entity, the Palestinian Liberation Organization. And later on in the show, we're going to get into that history. But it seems that every American government that comes in, or every new administration, follows a period of a relationship with the Israelis where they try and push peace on them. Now, Mr. Trump says that he's not going to push anything on either side, yet that remains to be seen. Well, just this week, as I said, we saw his first foray into this arena, and that was by sending his point man, Mr. Jason Greenblatt, to Israel this past week to meet with all of the parties involved. Just by way of introduction to his visit, I'm going to quote from the Jerusalem Post by an article from Michael Wilner. He said this: "Seasoned diplomats and ambitious politicians from the left and right have tried and failed spectacularly in their efforts to forge peace in the Middle East, one following the other, promising a fresh approach to peacemaking and to rid Israelis and Palestinians of stale thinking and faint hearts. Never did Jason Greenblatt, a lawyer from New York, think he would be among this esteemed group of frustrated dealmakers. He enters the fray as President Donald Trump's special representative for international negotiations, armed with a critical trait, sincere humility, for the privilege to work towards peace in a region he cares deeply about and in service of a man he believes has the capacity to deliver." Then the article says, as with Jared Kushner, Trump's orthodox son-in-law and senior advisor, to whom he will report, Greenblatt brings no diplomatic or governmental experience to the table, but that is what Trump represents and the experiment that America has chosen to try in electing him. And so that experiment is now applied to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israelis and Palestinians are hopeful his lack of conventional experience will lead Greenblatt to approach the world's most intractable conflict with an open mind and genuinely fresh ideas. So it's interesting here, Mr. Trump's selection. He is an Orthodox Jew. He has not been involved in any type of negotiations in the past. And they're hoping for fresh ideas to a peace process or a conflict, really, that's been going on for 70 years, and to trying to resurrect a peace process that largely has completely failed over the past almost 30 years now. Now, the State Department came out and said that this past week was mainly Greenblatt's orientation, where he met all the different parties involved. And then Haaretz said this about his trip. President Trump's envoy, Jason Greenblatt, proved this week that even if he lacks the experience of veterans of the peace industry in America, he is blessed with sharp instincts, seriousness, common sense, and a great deal of personal charm and emotional intelligence. Everyone on the Israeli side who met with Greenblatt this week, on both the right and the left, as well as everyone on the Palestinian side, had a positive impression. That's what Haaretz said. So apparently this is the right man. Everybody loves him. Is he going to work out a peace deal between the Israelis and the Palestinians? Most definitely not. He is not going to be able to do it. And yet everybody is hopeful. This Haaretz piece continued. He surprised many by meeting with Palestinian residents of the Jelazan refugee camp near Ramallah and with settlement leaders. He met with Palestinian and Israeli students, with residents of Gaza, with senior Jewish, Christian, Muslim clerics. The message Greenblatt reiterated was that President Trump is very serious when he talks about his desire to, quote, make the ultimate deal, and that the Israeli-Palestinian peace, and that Israeli and Palestinian peace is very high on his priority list. So it looks like he was doing the right thing. He was meeting everybody involved, going further than many of the previous American administrations have, not just meeting with the leaders, but Palestinians, settlement, people living in settlements, everybody. Now, we assumed, well, it was assumed generally, that Mr. Trump was going to be extremely pro-Israel, and even just as he came into office, Israel did allow a lot of more settlement construction to take place. They largely saw it as a green light, or at least a temporary green light, on settlement construction inside the West Bank. And yet now it seems that he is going to push for a peace deal as hard as he can. And whether that means he's going to remain pro-Israel, or whether we're seeing a change, we'll have to wait to see. Now, he is a very elusive figure in terms of what he really wants from Israel. This is what Melanie Phillips wrote this week. She's a columnist for the Times of London, and then also she writes for the Jerusalem Post. She said this: at first, he was hailed as massively pro-Israel. He said he was opposed to the Iran deal and Israel's treatment by the UN. He promised to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem and appoint a U.S. ambassador, as U.S. ambassador, a bullish supporter of the settlers. Jews on the right were thrilled. Jews on the left were dismayed. But then he invited Mahmoud Abbas to the White House and sent his envoy, Jason Greenblatt, to make peace, or make nice, sorry, with him in Ramallah. Asked Benjamin Netanyahu to hold back on settlement building and backpedaled on moving the embassy. Jews on the right are now dismayed. Jews on the left are now thrilled. Now, she says that everyone just ought to calm down and we'll see what happens. You never know whether he's going to proceed to another foreign policy car crash or a genius deal. She says we don't know. But really, we do know. We do know the end result of this push towards peace. And we can go to the Bible for that. And in the latter part of today's program, we're going to see that. But at least on purely political terms, if he's going to push a peace deal, or wants a peace deal between Israel and the Palestinians, history should tell us that the Palestinians haven't been willing to give up much, haven't been willing to compromise much. They have been offered a lot. They have been offered the West Bank already back in 2000. And yet they rejected that. They rejected a state for themselves numerous times, even going back to 1948. So really, any peace deal that Mr. Trump pushes is going to rely on Israel, if he wants it to move forward, to make some big concessions, some big compromises. And even Mr. Trump has indicated that. This is what Mr. Trump said soon after he was elected, soon after he came into office, during his first joint press conference with Mr. Netanyahu from Washington.
The Israelis are going to have to show some flexibility, which is hard. It's hard to do. They're going to have to show the fact that they really want to make a deal. I think our new concept that we've been discussing actually for a while is something that allows them to show more flexibility than they have in the past, because you have a lot bigger canvas to play with. And I think they'll do that. I think they very much would like to make a deal, or I wouldn't be happy and I wouldn't be here and I wouldn't be as optimistic as I am. I really think I can tell you from the standpoint of Bibi and from the standpoint of Israel, I really believe they want to make a deal and they'd like to see the big deal.
So he says that Israel wants to see the big deal. He says that Israel is going to have to be flexible. They're going to have to be flexible if they want a deal. And I'm sure they would have to be flexible, just like they've been flexible many instances for the past 25, 30 years in giving a lot over to the Palestinians in hope of peace, peace that is still elusive. Now, how they believe that they're going to move forward with this, as well as Mr. Netanyahu believes he's going to move forward on this, is a wider deal. They're pinning their hopes on a wider deal between Israel and other Sunni Arab states. Sunni states such as Egypt, Saudi Arabia, and Jordan. They have a far closer relationship with the Jews, the Israeli state, than they've done in the past, simply because they're all afraid of Iran. They're all afraid of Iran's march across the Middle East, which again is prophesied in your Bible. And they are banding together and they are coming together with Israel because they value Israel as a help in the fight against Iran. Now, this relationship of convenience between some of these Sunni states and Israel, that is due to fail as well. And yet, Mr. Netanyahu, as well as some members in his government, as well as, it seems, Mr. Trump, believes that if he can get these Arab states on side, then it'll be easier for the Palestinians to be pressured to make a deal as well. However, I really do want to quote now from Carolyn Glick. She's written two columns. Her latest one here is very important. It's entitled Column 1, Know Your Enemy. And it really is the most incisive analysis of the heart of what is going on here. And it's something that backs up that earlier quote I gave from Mr. Flurry that labeled the peace process as a deadly wound. Again, he said that back right after it was made, right after the Oslo Accords were made. Back in 1993, he said that this peace process was Israel's deadly wound. It's not the fact that they would want peace. There's nothing wrong with wanting peace. It's the fact that they chose a long time ago to enter into these peace negotiations with a terrorist group. Instead of following biblical examples, relying on God, having faith and hope that God would provide them with safety, protection, without doing a deal with a terrorist group. This is what Carolyn Glick writes. And again, I'm going to include this in the show notes for you. You should go ahead and read all of it. And as you do, remember that she's looking back on this history and saying that the whole premise for these negotiations is wrong. The whole foundation is wrong. You're legitimizing the PLO or a terrorist group as the representative of the Palestinian people. And that is not wise. And that is what Mr. Flurry did call the deadly wound back almost 30 years ago. She writes this: "This week, we have been beset by the bizarre and sudden appearance of Jason Greenblatt, President Donald Trump's negotiations chief. Greenblatt's mission is apparently to reinstate the Mordaunt peace process between Israel and the PLO. The peace process that Greenblatt is here to reincarnate died 17 years ago." And then she backs up some history here of what happened 17 years ago. She said, in 2000, PLO chief and Palestinian Authority chairman Yasser Arafat killed the peace process when he initiated a massive terrorist war against Israel right after he rejected peace and Palestinian statehood at the Camp David peace conference. So he was offered by Ehud Barak at the time, he was offered a state, a Palestinian state. He rejected it, and then the Second Intifada broke out soon after that. Carolyn Glick continues, "In Rejecting Peace, the architect of modern terrorism made clear that his claim 7 years earlier that he was willing to reach a compromise with Israel based on partition of the land of Israel between a Jewish and an Arab state was a lie. He with rejecting that claim, he, or rejecting that state that he was offered, it showed what happened on the White House lawn in 1993 when Yitzhak Rabin shook the hand of Yasser Arafat that started out the Oslo Accords, that there was going to be a Palestinian state and that the Israel was going to give them land and in return they were going to get peace. But they were offered the land in 2000 and yet they rejected it. Yasser Arafat rejected it. This is what she continues to write, Carolyn Glick, as the nationalist camp had warned at the time and since, the PLO was not remotely interested either in statehood or in peace. Arafat's willingness to engage Israel in negotiations that led to its transfer of security and civil control over Gaza and the Palestinian population centers in Judea and Samaria to the PLO was simply another means to the only end the PLO ever contemplated. It was a means of weakening Israel as a step towards achieving the PLO's ultimate goal of destroying the Jewish state. That's their ultimate goal. They don't want to, they won't be happy with a state alongside the Jews. They would want more than that. And they've rejected that in the past. And again, who was doing the negotiating here? Who was representing the Palestinian people? It was the PLO. Yasser Arafat, terrorist in chief. And who is leading the negotiations right now for the Palestinian side? Mahmoud Abbas, the man that followed on from terrorist in chief Yasser Arafat and the PLO, while they might have changed their stripes in light of some of the foreign powers of this world, in light of what the European Union thinks and someone in the United States think, he's still committed. The PLO is still committed to the destruction of Israel. This is what Carolyn Glick continues to write in 1993, when then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin agreed to recognize the PLO. His implicit assumption was that if Arafat was lying, Israel would walk away from the peace process. It would retake control of the areas it had ceded to the PLO control, and things would go back to the way they were before he even made the gamble. Indeed, that would be better because, whereas for years Israel had been under pressure from the Europeans and the Americans to recognize the PLO, if Israel recognized a terrorist group and the PLO responded by showing that it remained dedicated to Israel's destruction, the world that had been pressuring Israel would end its pressure. The Europeans and Americans would rally to Israel's side against the PLO. They would realize that it was a farce. That's what Yitzhak Rabin thought. It was going to be win-win. They could simply retract those things that they gave the Palestinians back in 1993. And yet, that's not what happened. This is what she continues to write in 2000. After Arafat blew up the negotiations table with his suicide bombers, then Prime Minister Ehud Barak announced triumphantly that he had ripped the mask off Arafat's face. Now everyone would recognize the truth about the PLO. Now the Europeans and the Americans would rally to Israel's side. Of course, things didn't work out that way. So in every instance that we've seen, 2000 back in 1993, and even in 2006, we've seen Israel give up concessions. They have been flexible, as President Trump is now asking. And each time, the Palestinians have gained a little bit more credibility, gained control over more land, and each time they haven't renounced violence, they have continued their violence. And Israel, these Israeli leaders that were willing to do this, these deals, would then somehow say, well, now finally the world will realize. That's what Ariel Sharon thought when they decided that they were going to give up the Gaza Strip. Okay. They want land for peace, and there's a few thousand, or just under 10,000 Jews inside the Gaza Strip. Let's take out those Jews from there. Let's destroy those settlements and give that state to the Palestinians on the Gaza Strip. Then we don't have to be burdened with protecting those Jews left in the inside the Gaza Strip. And then if it fails, then we can show the world that we gave them a state and they're not committed to peace. They're not committed to peace. They're not renouncing violence. Then finally, the world will be on our side. Well, again, things didn't work out that way. And yet, we see Israel still pursuing this peace process, these negotiations with a Palestinian leadership that is still dedicated to Israel's destruction. This is Israel's deadly wound. And if we're going to look at the very beginnings of this deadly wound, it really does go back even before that handshake on the White House lawn in 1993. And it goes back to the Israeli leader that has just died in the past year, Mr. Shimon Peres. Now, going to the late 80s, we had possible negotiations going forward, but for some type of peace arrangement between the Israelis and a Palestinian people, but that was all going to be brokered through the Jordanians, through Jordan. And yet, it looked like, after those talks got revealed to the press, that Jordan kind of said, well, we weren't actually doing that. And then Shimon Peres said, well, we might have to go ahead and negotiate directly with the Palestinian Authority. Now, this is the beginning of this deadly wound. And yet it even goes back before then. There were some inklings that this was going to happen back in 1986. Now, this is an article from the Christian Science Monitor dated January 24th, 1986. And at the time, Peres, he was in, I think it was the Netherlands or Britain, on a European tour. And he was talking about the chance that they had of a peace deal with Mr. Hussein, King of Jordan, and the Israelis, with the Palestinians being involved. He said 1986 is a crucial year. It may be the very best year for peace. If wasted, the opportunity may never return. That's what he said. And this is what the article writes. He said, he spoke for the first time of a need to facilitate Palestinian self-expression. The article continues, this stops short of a recognition of the Palestinian right to self-determination, which the Palestinian Liberation Organization has insisted must be the basis for peace or negotiation. But it went further than Peres or any other Israeli leader has been willing to go publicly toward recognizing the need to deal with the Palestinians as a people with a political aspiration beyond those of refugees. So in the background to these Jordanian negotiations, he's already going further than anyone else has before about recognizing the need to deal with the Palestinians themselves as a people. And speaking about their claims to the land of Israel. And then it was about a couple of years later that we saw Peres in the background, even behind Rabin, writing secret letters to Yasser Arafat and back and forth that led to the Oslo Accords. This political bargain with a terrorist that said, if you renounce violence, we will give you land. Land for peace. And yet they have received land. And yet, where is the peace? Now they want more land. Will there be peace that follows? And this is why it's a deadly wound. It was created by Israeli leaders, and it's been perpetuated by every Israeli leader since. Yes, there have been some that are less willing to give up land or less willing to make compromises than others. But all of them, have dealt with the Palestinian Liberation Organization as the representative of the Palestinian people. Now, logic should tell you, if you're dealing with a terrorist organization and they are your partner for peace, that you're not going to have peace. And yet Israel continues down this road, and even Mr. Netanyahu, by welcoming Mr. Trump's peace initiatives he is falling into this same trap as well, and that's what Carolyn Glick brings out. But again, I said before I wanted to go to the Bible and really show how this was prophesied. This was prophesied a long time ago, this wound that Israel would experience. And this wound is a peace negotiation. Doesn't seem like it would be a wound, and yet it is. How it has hamstrung Israel for the past 30 years. Now, this is a quote from Jerusalem in Prophecy by Gerald Flurry. And you can request that booklet by going to Watch Jerusalem and hitting the literature tab. You can request a hard copy of it. You can download it and read it right there. There is a chapter entitled Israel's Deadly Wound. And this is what he writes. The book of Hosea was written as a prophecy for the end time. And then he says, again, the nation called Israel today is really biblical Judah. And we've covered that before on this program. There are some specific prophecies about Judah in this book. And then he quotes one, the book of Hosea. When Ephraim saw his sickness, and Judah saw his wound, then went Ephraim to the Assyrian, and sent to King Jared, yet he could not heal you, nor cure you of your wound. Then he writes, studying this verse in the original Hebrew reveals that both Ephraim and Judah go to Assyria. Or, that is, in our day, modern-day Germany. Then he writes, why do the Jews go to Germany, and what is Judah's wound? He said this word wound here means in the sense of binding up a bandage or a remedy. And so he says, really, this remedy is the wound. This remedy is the wound. Something that is meant to fix the problem that you're experiencing is actually the wound. It's making it worse for you. And he goes on to describe this wound being the peace process. The peace process, because they, instead of relying on the great God that has given Israel their land, that provided miracle victory after miracle victory, War of Independence, Six-Day War, even the Yom Kippur War, God was very obviously behind those victories for the tiny state of Israel. And yet, what happened to those miracle victories? What's happened to them in the past 20 or 30 years? Well, they've entered into this stage where they have been wounded. And they're wounded by this peace process. He goes on to write here, there is a deadly delusion that all problems can be solved by negotiation. Such a philosophy destroys nations. No great nation has ever been built or sustained by such a belief. Any good history book should teach us that. Bible prophecy certainly does. It's a philosophy based on weakness. A powerful nation that reasons from such weakness is plummeting to disaster. Through weakness and a lack of faith in God, the Jews have created their own wound. They've really created their own wound. Now that's sad, because they, unlike every other nation on the planet, have a history with God, and a lot of them know their history with God. Many people fighting in the Six-Day War knew their history of God, with God, and they did rely and pray for God to help them through these battles that they faced. And yet now, they've created a wound. A wound. He writes, he continues, because of the land they have already given to the Palestinians, the Jews can no longer even pursue their enemy. And you would think that the Palestinians would be grateful to the Jews for the land they've already been given. Instead, they use that gift to intensify their hatred. A little psychology ought to convince any honest person that a peace pact will never work. It'll never work. But the Jews cling to their illusions because of weakness. The Jews are afraid to get tough, even in the Arab areas. Then he writes this, the real wound is spiritual, a lack of faith in God. The Jews keep trying to heal themselves by making these peace pacts. And yet there are so many ways that Israel could be strong. They were strong when they trusted God, he writes. And yet that trust in God has now been replaced by trust in themselves. In themselves and a hopeful peace process that is creating a deeper and deeper wound inside Israel that's dividing the nation like no other issue. Dividing the Jews amongst themselves and also shattering what remains of the Jewish faith. Now that faith could be rekindled, and on an individual basis, it most definitely can. Now, if you want to understand more about how that faith can be rekindled in a personal basis, then you need to read Jerusalem in Prophecy. You don't have to be in the dark. You don't have to wonder what's going to take place in the future for this city of Jerusalem and also for the nation of Israel. It's clear. It's been spelled out in your Bible, and it's been written. It's been written down in this book, Jerusalem in Prophecy. Again, please request it. It's free. It'll do you no harm to read it. It's not even that long. It'll probably take you a few hours to read through. And yet you can read it with the understanding that that was written 20 years ago, and watch and notice how those prophecies in there have already, so much of them, come to pass, including this prophecy about Israel's deadly wound. That's about all we have time for today. Thanks so much for listening to this program, Watch Jerusalem from Jerusalem, of course, and I'm Brent Nachtigall, your host. If you'd like to send me some feedback or the program or the website, watchjerusalem.co.il, you can do that by sending that to letters@watchjerusalem.co.il. We'll see you next week.